Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning and welcome to NPR News Presents, coming to you live from the Minnesota Public Radio booth here at the Minnesota State Fair. I'm Gary Eichten, and our guest this morning is Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. Senator, thanks for joining us. A lot nicer weather this year than last year.
Well, I will say, Gary, as it is our tradition to do this, as Kathy Werzer introduced you, I love that she said earlier that you are out talking to politicians as you do best. You know, that is kind of a claim to fame. But I think we know through history, even now that you're in a semi-retired state, that in fact you have interviewed Republicans, Democrats. Everyone has always felt that when they come on your show, they get a fair shake, and it's great to be out here. And I will say, of all the years we have done this, including some at the grandstand, that this is the nicest weather you and I have ever had.
So by far.
Congratulations to people that chose to come out here today.
Now, before we get started, I want to invite those of you who aren't here to stop by our booth sometime today or during the fair to say hello and check out all of our state fair specials, including signed copies of Senator Klobuchar's memoir, The Senator Next Door. We're located near the corner of Judson and Nelson, just down the street from the haunted house, and as a matter of fact, just down the street from Senator Klobuchar's booth here at the fair.
Just down the street from Bob Stink Zoo.
We don't talk about that a lot.
Okay. So. Thank you. I just wanted
to point that out. Those of you here in the audience, if you have a question for Senator Klobuchar, just raise your hand. And either Jeff or Elizabeth will get a microphone to you. And unless your question is really, really, really good, you're going to get stuck with one of these bobbleheads.
What is that bobblehead?
Well, this is an old retired midday radio host.
It's a Gary Eichten bobblehead. That's
yes.
Pretty good.
The punishment for people who ask questions. So, anyway. Senator, I want to talk about a lot of policy issues this hour, but I wanted to start with Donald Trump's charge that this fall's election is going to be rigged. And, of course, if that's true, it would undermine our whole system of government in this country. Is there any possibility in your mind, and we know that you're supporting Hillary Clinton, but is there any possibility in your mind that Trump is right? Is this election rigged?
And no, it is not rigged. I think we all know we have to be in this day and age concerned about cybersecurity, of course. And we have all this evidence that Russia now has been hacking into various political websites and political databases. And even as we've learned in the last few days, some of the trying to get into some of the voter databases in places like Arizona, although it appears as though that was thwarted. So the cybersecurity side, I think we do have to watch out for, and I know they will be monitoring that, and also that can be protected by having a paper ballot as backup, like we do in Minnesota, where you can check the results. But this idea that Trump is putting out there is a step beyond that, right? People are going to be able to notice if you've been hacked. What this is about is he's saying that you can't trust our election system in America. Well, I'd point to close elections like in Minnesota and that recount we had in the Frank and Coleman race. That wasn't easy for our state. You know, we had to have every single ballot gone through. But when I look at that race and what happened was how graciously both candidates ended it. Norm Coleman actually came out and said, look, I lost, but I respect the system. I respect the results. And when he did that, that gave a lot of his supporters some faith in our democracy, as they should have. And that is not how Trump is talking. In fact, he's setting it up already that you shouldn't trust the results. And that really bothers me to have a major candidate doing something like that, because we try our best. Mistakes are sometimes made in certain precincts, and things happen across this great United States of America. I would change a lot of these laws so they'd be more like Minnesota, so you could have same-day registration and less long vote lines, having voting be easier for people by ballot. There's all kinds of things we should be doing to improve the system. But that being said, to basically before an election say that things are rigged. I just don't think that's responsible in America.
If Donald Trump wins, can you and other Democrats work with him?
Okay, so I'm not going to go into that hypothetical with you that that's going to happen. I think that part of a democracy is that no matter who wins a race, as an elected member of Congress, as any elected member does, you try to work with whoever wins a race. I don't think people predicted that Jesse Ventura was going to be the governor of Minnesota, right? And I'm sure there were some people of both major parties that thought, well, this is going to be impossible. They found a way to do it. That being said, and that is my attitude about how a democracy should work and how a transition of power should work. That being said, I would be incredibly concerned about Donald Trump as president based on what he has said, his temperament, the foreign policies that he's talked about, including adding nuclear weapons to countries that don't have them, destroying our NATO alliance that has been so important to us in so many conflicts around the world. And I know he's going to be speaking on immigration tomorrow, but the things that he has said about deporting millions of people, some of whom came into this country through no fault of their own, talking about not allowing Muslims to even enter our country in a state where we are proud of our Somali population and a state that has built on refugees, whose economy in part has been built on refugees. When you look at the Hmong that have come in, the Oromo from Ethiopia that I just met with yesterday, and so many groups that have come in that have been not just a part of our fabric of life in Minnesota, but also a major part of our economy. We have a low unemployment rate, and if you go out to some of those places in greater Minnesota, they need workers still, and that is how we've been able to make our state great and be an economic powerhouse. So I see this as some of his policies as threatening not just the foreign policy side of things, but also significantly the economic side of things.
Another question, then I want to get to some audience questions. And again, if you have a question for the senators, raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Overall, Senator, what do you see are the biggest challenges that are going to face whoever wins the election in November? What should be their, you know, one or two top priorities?
Well, I think one thing that has been sitting in the deep freeze in the House of Representatives right next to the frozen peas would be immigration reform. We passed a strong bipartisan bill in the Senate. And again, I go back to the fact that 70 of our Fortune 500 companies, 70 of them are headed up by immigrants. Over 25% of our Nobel laureates were born in other countries. These are the U.S. Nobel laureates. So part of the competitive edge of this country has been that policy. And the bill we passed had more order at the border and a lot of funding to cut down on illegal immigration. But then it also did something about making a more orderly system for legal immigration. So I think that's one thing you'll see. Because of that bipartisan support we have in the Senate and a lot of noises from the Republican Party that they may want to get a compromise on it. Secondly, tax reform, you know, these inversions that are going on where you have good American companies that find it in their tax benefit to incorporate overseas, creating disincentives to that and at the same time creative incentives to bring back the trillions of dollars that's just sitting over there. And a lot of us would like to tie it to an infrastructure bank, Democrats and Republicans, so that could boost our transportation funding even more than what we're already doing by getting that money to come back with some tax incentives and then putting a chunk of it into infrastructure. It could be the biggest infrastructure investment we've had in years and something we need in this country. So that's something, I think, the example. And we can talk about, I hope, later, the pharmaceutical issues, what we just saw with EpiPen, negotiating under Medicare Part D. That's something Hillary Clinton wants to do, and a lot of us, including some Republicans, want to start moving on when we get back. So I think I've always been saying that for many times when I've come on this show at the fair, we've been governing from crisis. We had the economic downturn. We have had situations where we lost more jobs in 1 month than there are people in Vermont. Right now, we are governing from opportunity. Things in our economy are stable, and this is a situation that we have to seize on, which we've done so many times in this country, and that is to get more kids into those careers that we need in science, technology, engineering, and math, making it easier for them to do that. urging them to go into those careers, training workers in the jobs that we have, and we really can then keep that competitive edge that we've had around the world.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar is our guest. This is NPR News Presents, coming to you live this morning from the Minnesota State Fair. We're at the NPR booth. And again, if you're out at the fair, stop by and say hello. Take a look at all the goodies that are available, and love to talk with you and meet you. Let's get to some audience questions. Let's start over here. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
We have Julie from St. Paul with a question about Syrian refugees.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
With regards to the immigration policies, is there a fast track for those situations like Syria that are degrading at such a rapid rate when there are already family members here in Minnesota that would be more than willing to host?
That's a really good question. Now, we know on the Syria front that we have 11 million refugees. About half of them are outside of the country now. And they are, of course, mostly concentrated. And I visited the refugee camp in Jordan, and they're concentrated in Turkey. And they're not the only reason we have such migration going on into Europe, but they are a big part of the reason. It's a tragic situation in Syria. And as I said at the outset, our country has always been a beacon for refugees. We also have been very careful compared to some countries in Europe in terms of the vetting that we do with these refugees. And that's pretty important. And we now, with technology, are better able to track where people came from. So a while back, I was one of the group of people that said, what are we doing after visiting there? When we have our economy stable, we can take in some more refugees. They are legal when they come in, so then they're able to fill some of the jobs. You should go down to southern Minnesota at some of the Hormel plants down there, and a number of refugees from Burma are working at some of those plants now, and we have been able to integrate them in the community. Look at the Hmong population. All right, so I asked those questions, and back then we literally had only taken in like 100, 200 Syrian refugees, and there's 5 million out there. So we called on the administration, always saying we had to put the best vetting process in as possible, and they have done that. And we now have gotten 10,000 this week Syrian refugees in. I will say that I think Canada's up to 25,000 or something like that in a much smaller country. So I'd like to continue that, the flow of those refugees. In terms of Minnesota, usually they tend to put refugees in certain areas where there's already a community. We have not had as big a community of Syrians in Minnesota. We've had Somalis and we have Hmong, right? They send a lot. We have Liberians, we have the Oromos, we have Ethiopians, we have a lot of different communities. So while we have received some, I remember I checked last March and it was just less than 10. I'm sure there'll be more coming in. Right now, this is not where all the Syrian refugees are going, simply because we didn't have that base of a population like you do in other states, like, say, Detroit. And so I'm sure that we will get more, but we're not one of those population centers for where those refugees are. But I appreciate the question because, as I said, this is part of our economy in our state. It's part of our moral obligation. But we have to make sure people are safe. And there are terrorists out there. There are people trying to abuse the system. But I don't think in this modern era that we can say, well, we're just going to shut everything down. Because there's some bad guys out there. I think what we have to say is we will put the best possible system in place, and that we will have as a mantra, which I had as a prosecutor, we convict the guilty, but we protect the innocent. And protecting the innocent means not just opening our arms to people from very, very difficult situations, and many of them are women and children, but it is also how we treat them when they get here. And I think that's been a major dialogue going on in the country this year. I loved all the churches and synagogues in Minnesota that had the Ramadan signs up. I like lawn signs anyway. I'm a politician. But I think that was a sign that people were saying, we welcome Muslims in our community. I will say that having been a prosecutor through 9/11 and seeing some of the hate crimes that came out of that, working with Tom Heffelfinger, who was the Bush-appointed U.S. attorney at the time, I think we had things, worked out pretty well after that in Minnesota. We actually caught one of the terrorists, Moussaoui, and people accepted that community. What happened this last summer with the rhetoric out there? I was at a mosque in Minneapolis and heard the story of a family of four, mom, dad, two kids. They go to a restaurant. They're just sitting there eating dinner. Guy walks by and says, "You four go home. You go home to where you came from." And the little girl looks up at her mom and says, "Mom, I don't want to go home. You said we could go out to dinner tonight. I want to eat dinner here." You think of the innocent words of that child. She only knows one home. That's Minnesota. She only knows one home. That's the United States of America. She didn't even know what that guy was talking about. So I think a lot of our job, this election, whether leaders, citizens, is to tell people that may say stuff like that, just hold on. We all came from somewhere. We all have immigrant relatives from the past. And let's really talk about what Minnesota is all about. And I think whether it's on social media, whether it is in your workplace at the coffee spot, just being willing to stand up for people, I think is going to be really important, whether at the voting booth or in your own workplace.
Let's go over here where Jeff Jones is celebrating his birthday today at the fair with his microphone in hand, so you folks can ask questions. Go ahead, Jeff.
Happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank
We're
you.
All going to sing to you, but you have the microphone, so we can't.
Please don't. No, this is no place I'd rather be. And I'm here with Dan, who came down from Duluth with a question.
Good morning, Senator Klobuchar. My question to you is probably a little bit more lighthearted than Syrian refugees. I'm from northern Minnesota, so my question is there any projects or policies happening in northern Minnesota that makes you excited for that region of the state specifically?
Okay, wow, that's a good one about northern Minnesota, because I think a lot of times people focus on one or two industries up there, and there's a lot of things happening. First of all, obviously, there's mining, and we just have had a really difficult time with dumping coming from China, and it's been very concerning. 2,000 people laid off, and a group of us got together, including the governor and Representative Nolan, Senator Franken, we in the Senate have introduced some bills. We passed a few bills, actually, to make it easier to stop this horrendous illegal practice where cheap steel has been coming in on our shores. We were able to get the president's chief of staff to come up there in the middle of December. Yes. And I will never forget that meeting. One steelworker named Dan Hill that I later brought to the State of the Union, he looked across the way at the president's chief of staff, and he said, "You know, my little kid just graduated from preschool, and the teacher says, 'What do you want to be when you grow up?' And he says, 'I want to be a miner like my daddy.'" And Dan Hill takes a steelworker T-shirt and puts it in his hand, throws it across the way to McDonough, who's a former football player, right, for St. John's. McDonough catches it, and Dan Hill says, "Make it come true for my kid, Mr. McDonough." Let's just say that was remembered by the president's chief of staff. So they have pledged they're doing more with inspectors on the shores. They're doing more. And so the Cleveland Cliffs CEO, as you know, has reopened two of the plants, bringing back hundreds and hundreds of workers. It's still tough up there, but they are expanding a new plant, Mustang Pellet. We're excited about that. That's one thing. The second thing is forestry. The price of the logging is pretty high right now. Boise has a really good owner up there now. I was just up there. They're staying strong in I Falls. And so we think, despite the downturn, which really knocked a lot of us out in the market, there's still a steady market in forestry. Third thing, tourism. That includes the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. That includes Duluth, which at one point there were billboards outside of Duluth with big signs that said, "Last one who leaves turns the lights out," right? This was decades ago. Wow, is it different now? You've got hotels packed. You've got that beautiful waterfront, bike paths, tribute to the leadership in Duluth, including former Mayor Don Ness, and some of the things that have been going on up there. Craft breweries. Oh, man, there's a... in Halleck, there's a distillery for rye whiskey. We soon may become the rye whiskey capital of the United States, and I'm not kidding, because we can use the rye that's grown in Minnesota. So that's happening. Cirrus, making jets up there, a major employer. And the tourism industry all the way up the North Shore, all the way across Brainerd Lakes area. The fact that Jim Oberstar was ahead of his time with bike paths has made it really accessible up there. So I don't really want to be a Pollyanna. We have huge challenges, but I will tell you, it's beautiful up there. And if you still want to go on that little Labor Day vacation, head up to northern Minnesota. Is that your good answer? Okay, thank you.
Quick follow-up, Senator. When, especially when you talk about northern Minnesota, but not just northern Minnesota, agriculture industry, so on and so forth, on balance, are these international, big international trade agreements good for Minnesota?
Well, it depends, Gary. And, you know, I voted for a Korea trade agreement. I voted for Panama. I didn't vote for Colombia. I look at these things on a case-by-case basis. And there's always something in them that is usually good for Minnesota, particularly in the agriculture area. But you have to balance that with the harm that can be done. And clearly, there's concerns with that part of our state because of the fact that you have steel and ore that's mined in other countries that it's done at a much cheaper price because they don't have the kind of labor rules and other things in place, and it could literally decimate an entire industry. So there is always that push and pull in looking at the details of an agreement and looking at what do you do to protect workers if there is job loss, which I think is a fair thing to do. This is about our country, and some people benefit and some people lose from these trade agreements. So I think you need not just free trade but fair trade, and that's how I look at each agreement.
Elizabeth.
Jerry from Minneapolis has two questions.
It's Gordy from Minneapolis, but that's all right.
What is it?
Two
Gordy?
Big questions. Gordy, yeah.
Okay.
All right. First of all, thank you for coming out, Amy. We're glad to see you. And my first question is, what committees are you serving on in the Senate? And my second question is, do you have any feelings? What are the chances of getting a new Supreme Court justice before November? I know it's probably not much.
Okay. Well, those are good questions. All right. So, first of all, I serve on the Commerce Committee, and that's allowed me to do a lot of work with transportation, like when there were those huge lines at the airport nightmare. I was able to get the head of the TSA out there within 5 days after calling for him to come. It's a good committee. I also am on the Joint Economic Committee. I'm actually the highest-ranking Democrat on there, so when it switches back, I'll either be the chair or the ranking, depending on what happens with the House. I'm on the Rules Committee, which will be in charge of the inauguration. There you go, among many other things. I serve on the Agriculture Committee, which was one of my top choices when I got to the Senate. I'm now second in line to chair it. And then the fifth one, which goes to your question, is the Judiciary Committee, where I am one of the leaders in the antitrust area. On the Merrick Garland, I'm actually going to be talking to him in the next week. He called to set up a call. This has been an atrocity for our country when you look at our Constitution, no matter where you are politically. When you look back in time since we first started having hearings in the Judiciary Committee about nominees since 1916, we have had a hearing for every nominee except about 10 of them, and those 10 were confirmed within about 10 days, right? So everyone's gotten a hearing except this guy. And this is a nominee who, when he was elevated to the D.C. court, was actually received strong bipartisan support. Orrin Hatch, conservative Republican, took to the floor and actually said, I challenge anyone to come to say anything bad about this guy. He was the chief prosecutor and the manager of both the Oklahoma City bombing case and the Unabomber case. He is someone that's known as bringing judges together when he does opinions. And it just shocks me that this has happened. I will say a few of my colleagues, Republican colleagues, have asked for a hearing. I have also thought to myself, well, what would I do if we had the opposite? We had a Democratic Senate and we had a Republican president. And I have firmly said I would call for a hearing. I don't know how I'd vote on them, but at least you have to give the nominee that chance so you can move the process along. So even if you don't have the vote right away, you can have that part of the process done. We literally have had multiple 4-4 decisions. The lower courts don't get any guidance when that happens, and our Constitution says that the Senate shall advise and consent. It doesn't say that we shall do it after an election when it's most convenient for one party. And more than just this individual man who literally shed tears as he stood in the Rose Garden. I was there when the president nominated him, and you knew he was crying not just because he knew the extraordinary honor it was to be nominated, but that he had the burden of the entire future of the federal judiciary on the shoulders. Because if they do this, will we do this to them then? When the next guy comes up or woman comes up, and then we're going to have this situation where we don't have a full court for years? We just can't afford to do that. So I am hopeful that this can get done eventually. And a lot of the outside money has been pushing on this, which gets to why we need to overturn Citizens United or pass a constitutional amendment to do that. But we must get this done as soon as possible.
You're listening to NPR News Presents. I'm Gary Eichten. Senator Amy Klobuchar is our guest, and we're coming to you live from the NPR booth here at the Minnesota State Fair. We're located near the corner of Judson and Nelson, just down the street from the Haunted House and right next to the French Fries. Do stop
and
by.
And across from me, which is always good for a politician, pork chop on a stick.
Well, there you go.
I kind of forgot that one. Yeah, okay.
Do stop by, say hello, pick up some nifty items that are on sale this year, including a copy of the senator's memoir, The Senator Next Door.
Which is also now out on paperback at
yes,
the University
that's
of Minnesota.
Well, it's not quite. We have to wait till Thursday.
Well, okay, Thursday, but it has a really nice new cover with a quote from Garrison Keillor saying that I'm chronically cheerful in the Elks Club that is the U.S. Senate. I thought that was good. I'll be signing it at the DFO booth this afternoon. Not, I'll stop my plug now. I'll stop it.
Oh, so you can get that at the booth.
Yes, you can. You can get it actually at some bookstores. It started to go out there.
Ah,
yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway,
can,
so
yes.
So hardcover here and paperback over at the booth.
Yes.
All right. Stick around as well. This is going to be a good show coming up right after we're done here at 10 o'clock. Tom Cran and Dr. John Hallberg will be on the stage. So get all your medical questions answered. Right now, let's get back to more questions for Senator Klobuchar. Jeff?
Yeah, speaking of medical questions, Mike from Burnsville has a question about health care.
Hi, Amy. My question is about health care insurance. I've heard that health care insurance companies are exiting from the exchanges. My question is, why is that happening? And then does that mean that we need some make some changes to Obamacare?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. I think we are in a situation now where we passed a bill that I think everyone knows gave some benefits that people want to keep. That's keeping your kids on your insurance till they're 26. That's something a lot of families I know have found to be a positive, not kicking people off their insurance for pre-existing conditions, which was one of the most helpful things for consumers, closing the donut hole under Medicare Part D, and containing some of the cost escalation that we've seen. That being said, for a certain percentage of the market, somewhere between 4-6% in Minnesota, that buy off the individual plans and buy off the exchange, there have been some of these companies are exiting the market, and we've seen some premium increases that we're not used to in our state. And it probably still puts us on par with other states, but it is not good enough. And so I think we do need to make some changes to the bill. You do that with any major piece of legislation, but we really haven't had the opportunity to do that because we keep seeing from the other side, repeal, repeal. I think next year that's going to stop. I think there's going to be some room for some bipartisan changes to the bill, and there are some issues with insurance companies and things we could do with things called risk corridors that would make some improvements, I think, for those people that is in that segment of the population who work hard and simply want to have some affordable insurance. I also think that the price of pharmaceuticals, something that I've been taking on big time this year, would make a major, major dent in this. Just to give you guys a sense of this, it's not just EpiPen, okay? The top 10 drugs in America, four of them have gone up over 100% in just the last few years. Insulin has tripled in 10 years, the cost of insulin. Canadian drugs now are 50% less than they are in America. The EpiPen is hundreds of dollars less. When I put up that price, the original price, before they got so much public pressure that they brought it down 50%, of $600, they went from $100 to $600, I had you know, people taking screenshots of online in Australia, or $150 in Britain, or $180 in Canada. That is actually, this is the same product that's selling for these kinds of prices in other places around the world. So why should Americans be ripped off? So that's why I think, one, negotiation of prices under Medicare Part D. Are those people that 4 to 6% in that? No, they're mostly not in Medicare. That's why. But does it help them? Enormously. Because when you take the power of all the nation's seniors and unleash them, how do you like to unleash every senior you know? Unleash it on negotiation. Okay, that was a senior laugh from Gary. And if you unleash that on the government and on the pharmaceuticals to negotiate lower prices, you get those lower prices, then that translates over to everyone's prices under the insurance policies. By allowing cheaper drugs to come in from Canada that are safe, John McCain and I have a bill. It's not just a Democratic bill. McCain and I are leading a bill to allow that to happen, and we want to vote. Here's the worst one. Pharma pays generics to keep their drugs off the market. There's actually deals that happen. The FTC has done some about it, but we can do more. And Senator Grassley, again a Republican, and I are leading a bill called Pay for Delay that would save billions of dollars for the government and consumers if we could stop those deals. You can Google this. I am not making this up. And pharma has so much power in Washington that it's been very hard to pass these bills. But it is time to do it. And the silver lining of the horrific story of EpiPen, where yesterday I had a woman sobbing who had three kids that needed EpiPen. Add up that money for her. The silver lining of this is that it has finally captured the attention of America. Because that is a big company. It's not just one guy off being crazy. It is a big company that did this. And when you look underneath the surface, they're all doing things like this, and it is time to rein it in.
Now, on EpiPen specifically, I guess they're going to offer a generic version of their injector, half the price, $300 rather than $600. Is that basically solve that problem?
It clearly is a step in the right direction. They offered two things. One is, first of all, they offered last Friday. It's been very interesting watching this. It's been kind of fun when you've been pushing it and put out all the stuff, and then suddenly they offer a discount where they give a $300 coupon. Then the other thing they did with the generics, which will be even a bigger deal because it'll get it out there, get the generic out there in the market. It will help, obviously. It basically is reducing the price in half. However, it is still more. It is still more than it is offered for in many other countries. And then the other part of it that bothers me is this will take time to get that done. But remember, when they just give the discount to consumers, you know, that sounds good. But the truth is that the insurance companies and the government are still paying. They're not getting these little discount coupons. And so they are still paying it, and it's being passed on to taxpayers. The generic will help with that. But again, I point out, when you look at the price of insulin, naloxone, you know, the drug we need to stop the overdoses from opiates, which maybe we can talk about later, that thing is shot up hundreds and hundreds percent. Why? Because there's a need. Every time there's any kind of a close to a monopoly situation like we see with EpiPen, they're at 85% of the market because one product got recalled and one product didn't get approved yet. When they're at 85% of the market, they get a monopoly in their lap, they're going to go for it. And that's what we're seeing. So getting other competitors in there and then acknowledging that it's not just one product. I'm hoping we're going to have hearings now. You're hearing about the hearings. I called for an FTC investigation. I think we're going to get that. And then you have to pass these bills.
Elizabeth, another question, please.
Pat from Minnetonka has a question about the upcoming presidential debate.
Hi, Amy.
Hey,
so nice
how are
to
you?
Meet you. I'm fine. Thank you. I first want to congratulate you on being the representative of Minnesota and for the country. I so admire your work. Yes, thank you so much. You are so respected throughout the country. But I'm kind of curious about this upcoming debate because of the different debate styles. Hillary is a great debater.
I love that nice Minnesota euphemism. The two candidates have different debate styles. But no, continue on.
Well, I'm listening to a lot of the different programs, news programs. They classify or characterize Donald Trump's style of debate as rumbling, you know, like in a wrestling match, and and Hillary is a more refined, disciplined debater, and they're concerned that she will be caught off guard by his style of debate. What do you think? I'm excited about the debate. What do you think? How do you think she will manage his style of debating?
Well, I think she has historically done very well in debates. You go way back to when she was running for Senate against Rick Lazio. And I remember there was this moment where he kind of went over with a petition that he wanted her to sign and, like, went right in her face. And she just handled with a lot of dignity. And the same with the debates during, actually, when President Obama emerged for the nomination. I think most people thought she did pretty well in those debates. She was, I think, maybe the one or one of only one or two, maybe just one women up on the stage. So it is different. I've seen that same look myself and have been in that same situation. You kind of look around, you feel a little shorter, right? You're like, okay. You don't look like the person that they expect to have in that office. So those are people's expectations that hopefully are changed by the fact that you've got women senators and governors and mayors and police chiefs all over the country. But there is that visual of seeing someone that looks different than what you're used to having in that job. And we've never had a woman president, and we've only, by the way, in the Senate had like over 1,900 male senators and only 46 women in the history of America. So there she's up there with him. And when you look at how she did in the debates with Senator Sanders, I think she more than held her own and was strong. So I'm not worried about it. And the fact that she prepares, I think that's a good thing. I think you want a president that's willing to prepare for a debate. Okay, that should be like pretty important. The whole nation is watching. He has a much more off-the-cuff style, that is correct, and has maybe more humorous, things like that. But he also has had a tendency to go off the rails in things that he has said in debates. And maybe that worked when he was just dealing with the base, the extreme base of the party, as opposed to moderate Republicans. And I think that it's going to be a wild time. I think he'll go in with low expectations, which is harder for her. I mean, it's gotten to the point where, you know, a day goes by where he doesn't go after someone. You know, first he went after, I was telling someone the other day, first he goes after the prisoners of war like John McCain and are, you know, for being captured. Then he went after women. Then he went after immigrants. Then he went after judges. Then he went after disabled persons. Then he went after the press. And really the only ones that were left that he hadn't gone after in America were babies. And then he went after a baby. Because it was at that one, he had an appearance, and he said, oh, ma'am, your baby's crying, but that's okay. And then about 10 minutes later, get the baby out of here. Okay, so there's really no one left. And I think because we've gotten so used to that, sadly, it seems like he can go one day, 5 days a week without doing something like that. And everyone goes, oh. So if he walks into the debate and doesn't say something completely crazy, then people think that's somehow a victory. Well, I'm hoping Americans are smarter than that and will actually listen to what the policies are and what he has been talking about and what he's been talking about the past when they listen to those debates.
Senator, did you ever imagine in your lifetime you would hear the things that we've been hearing during this presidential campaign, the subjects discussed, the way the subjects were discussed? I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Yes, it is. And I think, Gary, you know I'm someone that always has believed in civility. I think it's a major part of our democracy. I've tried really hard, even in this era of Donald Trump, when I make our case, to make our case in a civil and pragmatic way. I have a section of that book I wrote called Republicans I Have Loved to Work With. And I explain in there that there are a lot of people of good minds in both parties that like to work across the aisle and get things done. That's how we just got a transportation bill done. I see so many fine members of our military here that are here for Military Appreciation Day at the fair, may I add. And I think that they know that in the military, you work for America. You don't work for one political party or the other, and they work really hard not to politicize things. So I think that that has been really difficult for those of us that try to work in the middle, this era that we're in. But I still continue to believe that there are people of good minds and good hearts on both sides that want to work together. Tom Emmer and I worked together on Cuba, on opening our trade embargo with Cuba. And I can't tell what it's been a joy to work with him on that stuff. We have very different views on things. My favorite moment was when we talked to a bunch of millennials about Cuba at a bar on a Friday, and Tom went up to the podium, and he put his speech down, and he looked up, and he said, "Welcome, my fellow Republicans." And then he said, "Wrong speech." But anyway, he does this with humor, and we try to look for common ground. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that I think make politics a profession worthy of people's consideration, when you actually like what you're doing and you put your heart in the right place. And that is just not what we've seen in the rhetoric, but I believe we're going to get through it. I truly do, because there's just such big, big, big things. And part of what gave me actually feel good about all this, I told some of my colleagues on the phone, both parties, over the last week, was the fair, because people at the fair have actually gone out of their way, including some really conservative Republicans, to me, saying, "Look, I don't agree with you on anything, but thanks for being civil. Thanks for da-da-da." I feel like people here have been going out of their way to make up for some of the rhetoric that you're seeing out there. It's really extraordinary. And Minnesota has that reputation, and I hope that reputation will carry us through this election.
NPR News presents, coming to you live from the Minnesota State Fair, our booth at the fair. Our guest is Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. Not a lot of time left, but if you have a question for the senator, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Jeff?
Gary, this is Glenn from Oakdale.
Thank you, Senator, for being here.
Thank you.
My question is, when are you going to run for president?
Well, thank you there, Glenn. Now, I know that you're wearing a Twins cap, so that means that you must believe that anything is possible at any time, and that you are a man of great loyalty, which I truly, truly... No, that's not a boo. We're just being honest about this thing. So clearly the field is kind of full right now for doing that this time. But I just love representing Minnesota. You know that. In the past, we've had some really difficult times in the Senate. We lost Paul Wellstone. We've had a lot of people that have, because of the voters' decision or else, have come and gone. And I think having some consistency there has been really important in terms of getting projects done and getting bridges built and everything else that we need to do. So I've loved my job there, and that's what my focus is. But thank you, and really like that Twins hat.
If Hillary Clinton were to get elected... And
now, Gary, that question was over.
And kind of like, asked
it was
you,
if there's other people.
And asked you to be on serve in her cabinet. Would you do so?
Look, I would look at everything on a case-by-case basis, but I can tell you again, I love my job. And I answer those questions if I ever get those calls. That's what I said when the Supreme Court thing, and we got the great Merrick Garland, and I meant it. I just think there's so many people in politics that spend their whole time. When I was county attorney, I saw this. You know, they're thinking, what's the next thing I can do? As opposed to really loving the job they have then and getting it done, and then if something comes our way, looking at it that way. And that's what I've done and approached my work here. And in what other job can you be at an event, in this case, the state fair, at 6 a.m. on opening day, and have someone hand you a waffle with ice cream in it that is in the shape of a carp, okay? What other job called and tell you that it's called carpe diem, okay? That really happens in no other place.
You mentioned that it reminded us that you served as Hennepin County prosecutor, and I wanted to get a quick question in here before we wrap up. What, based on your experiences, your thoughts on what can be done to improve relations between African Americans and the police in this country, more specifically in Minnesota?
Well, it is a matter of trust, Gary, and that's something that I always held dear when I was county attorney. When I talked earlier about our situation with Syria. You know, this idea that we convict the guilty and protect the innocent. That doesn't just mean in individual cases. It also means in how we deal and work with the community. And I think that there are changes that we can make that will still keep our community safe. I have a good relation and enormous respect for our police. And I also have enormous respect for our African-American community and have been working with both of them. And so here's ideas. When I was in, we actually put in a new form of eyewitness ID because there were number one way that you convict innocent people actually is through wrongfully identifying them. And we've had many tragic cases around the country. We did that working with the police departments, and you could extend that around the country. We have in Minnesota videotaped interrogations. We are one of the first states through a court order to have done that. And it ended up working well, not just for those accused of crimes, but also for our law enforcement, because when there would be false accusations about police brutality or when there would be, hey, did they really read the Miranda rights or not, you would have proof right there on the video. You can extend that into these body cameras. Obviously, there's privacy issues and other things. But in the end, I think that is something as a way where we can build trust. Diversity of hiring, so important. Our police force should reflect the community that we serve. I'm so proud that we have dozens of Somali police officers in our police forces around the state and Hmong officers. I mean, that is really a part of what we're talking about here when we talk about what happens with our police force. Grand jury reforms, all kinds of things like that that I think would be helpful. So a lot of this, I guess I'd end with two things. One is the drug sentences on the federal level. I actually think there's a high chance that we could get that reform done in a lame duck session, if not early next year. Huge bipartisan support already pushed out of the Judiciary Committee that I serve on with Democratic and Republican support, including number two guy in the Republican side of the Senate, including a number of other Republicans. So that's good. And then the second piece of this is some reform to our gun laws and looking at background checks and other things that I think could be really helpful in high crime neighborhoods and in other places in our state. So there's a lot of good things we can do. But at its base, it's building that trust and having people reach out and also understand how many good people there are in the African-American community that just want to raise their families and do well here and love the people as much as we do. And then there's a lot of great police officers, the vast majority of them, who feel the same way. So it's been a really difficult time here with the Philando Castile and some of the cases that we've had, but we need to move to policies that work for everyone and keep our community safe. So thank you.
Jeff?
Yeah, a lot of questions about politics out here. Here's another one from
I wonder
Gary.
Why, you know.
Why could that be? Gary from Long Prairie.
Hi, Amy. I think you're doing a great job. What do you think?
Like Long Prairie.
What do you think the chances are of Democrats taking back the Senate?
This is the U.S. Senate that we're talking about. Obviously, we have some important legislative races here. But in the U.S. Senate, I think that the chances are over 50-50 for certain. We have some really good candidates all around the country. You know, Russ Feingold's running right next door in Wisconsin. And then we have a bunch of women candidates. As I told you, there's only been 46 women and 1,900 men in the history of the service in the Senate. Maybe time has come to add a few more. And that includes a candidate down in Nevada. Who's going to be running for Harry Reid's seat. We have a great woman in Pennsylvania, Katie McGinty, one of 10 children raised on a cop salary. She's got a fun ad if you want to see that with all her brothers and sisters. And there's just a number of races around the country where we have good chances of adding women, so I'd like to see that too. And obviously, whatever we have, it's going to be close in the Senate. There's no doubt about it. And with the way the filibuster rules work, you need 60 votes. So in the Senate, bipartisanship is everything to getting things done. You just aren't going to be able to do it with one party, except for rare instances in our history. And that means, of course, getting back some of the civility I talked to. And we've had some successes this last year with the transportation bill, the opioid bill that I was one of four leaders on in the Senate, two Democrats, two Republicans. We just passed that with more to come. And we need to continue that work no matter who wins the Senate. So thanks for the question.
Obama administration coming to an end, 8 years of President Barack Obama. How would you rate him compared to past presidents? What's his legacy going to be?
Well, I think I'd direct anyone to the Jim Brooks column that he wrote, David Brooks column that he wrote recently in the New York Times. And David Brooks, who's a Republican, said, you know what, when we're going to look back at that time, I think we're going to miss him. And what he talked about was just that steady leadership that President Obama has had through the worst of times, coming into office with that horrible bleed of losing jobs left and right and having to deal with that, and actually coming to a time now where we have had years and years of job growth every single month. And that's because he's had this laser focus on the economy. And he knows there's still challenges with minimum wage, with the cost of college, all these things we've touched on today. He knows that. But the fact that he was just steady and that he treated people well, I think maybe his wife said it best at the Democratic convention when she talked about how, yes, his groundbreaking policies, from being willing to talk about opening Cuba to working with the rest of the world in a different way to finally making some headway on an international agreement on climate change, all of those things have mattered. But what really mattered, as she talked about her little daughters playing out on that front lawn, they're no longer so little, with the dog, knowing that they are living in a house that was built by slaves. That wasn't just a lesson to African Americans. That was a lesson to all Americans, that the President of the United States, and Barack Obama is a great example of this, not only has to have a good temperament because he's got his hands on the nuclear code, but also has to be a role model for all those little children out there. And so in that way, Barack Obama has been an incredible role model of how you can be not just a president, not just a leader, but a dad.
All right, let's shoehorn one quick question, one more question. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Steve from Minneapolis has a question.
Senator Klobuchar, among the many things that I'm aware of are dividing us as a nation, brought to mind in this season, are the division between those who are comfortable with a diverse society and those who are uncomfortable with a diverse society. And I'm just wondering what you think we can do to bridge that gap.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this election will do a lot to bridge this gap. Elections matter. How many times have we heard this? But if we have a decisive win against some of this hateful rhetoric that we've heard, and this, again, I say looking for, and there are many good Republicans, especially in our state, who've been willing to stand up against it. Jeff Flake in Arizona, Republican senator, went to a mosque right after Trump had said all this stuff. And there's many, many examples of that. Emmer leading the Somali caucus with Keith Ellison, okay? So let's not forget that. But this election, where you defeat that kind of rhetoric, that matters. It really matters. And then you move on from there to some of the policies that we're talking about with refugees and how we treat people when they come in, because this is what's made America. I go back to what I said before. 70 of our Fortune 500 companies headed by immigrants, 25% of our U.S. Nobel laureates born in other countries. It's what's made us strong. And we all know we came from somewhere. In my case, my Slovenian relatives. Okay, yeah, okay. A little fact I haven't revealed. Melania grew up about half an hour away from my relatives. You can see the resemblance, okay? And my Swiss relatives on my mom's side, my grandparents came over. You know, my grandma when she was 3, and my grandpa through Ellis Island, and somehow snuck through from Canada, of all places. That's the history of America. It's... Here I am as the granddaughter of those two and the daughter of a teacher and a newspaper man and the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate from Minnesota. That's immigration.
Well, that is all the time we have this hour. Thanks so much for joining us, Senator Amy Klobuchar.